Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and because the summer of 2013 is just too damn hot, we're spending this week back in the past, revisiting the summer of 1993, which, by the way, was 15 degrees cooler on this date 20 years ago. I looked it up. And as part of this exercise, we're inviting you to tell us where you were 20 years ago and what you were listening to. There were big releases in play that summer. Janet Jackson, Nirvana's In Utero, that whoop, there it is thing. Don't pretend you don't know what I'm talking about. But that summer was also full of songs that came out earlier and were still hanging around on the radio and MTV. Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You, for example. But our listener Bob called in to remind us of another song released near the end of 92 that was still very popular in the summer of 93.
And summer of 93, I was in Sheepshead Bay, and if I'm not mistaken, I was listening to R.E.M.'s Man on the Moon with references to Andy Kaufman. Mr. Andy Kaufman's gone messing. And what it did was it made me reminisce about when I used to live in Los Angeles in the early 80s and refereed female mud wrestling. And Andy Kaufman came to the club one night and jumped in the mud with one of the mud wrestlers. And, of course, had to lend him some clothes to change into after he got done. But that's where I was in the summer of 93 in Sheepshead Bay, listening to R.E.M.'s Man on the Moon. And it was a good summer. A lot of good memories.
So Bob's good memories of the summer of 93 bring back even stranger memories for him from the early 80s. All right, what's your story from that summer 20 years ago? Tell us where you were and what you were listening to. You can call us at 866-939-1612, tweet us at Soundcheck, or comment on our website, soundcheck.org. That number again, 866-939-1612. Coming up, 20 years ago, the post-punk band Wire had already influenced a whole generation of bands, including R.E.M. Now they've made a new album out of sketches of old material, and they'll play live for us. But first, 1993 was rap's greatest year. That's according to Franny Kelly, an editor at NPR Music. She's been overseeing NPR's ongoing coverage of rap and hip-hop in 1993, and joins me here in our studio. Franny, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
So on NPR.org, you've billed 1993 as rap's greatest year.
I have.
Why?
The creative foment. In the 80s, rap becomes more popular, especially with the kids. And then in the early
90s. And then 1988 comes along, and it is rap's greatest year.
I've heard that
argument.
Period,
end of sentence. That's just the way it is.
But what it did was prove to advertisers and to commercial radio stations that they could make a little bit of money off this thing. So in 91, 92, companies start signing up kids, but they don't know exactly what they're doing. So the kids have freedom. And so in 93, you have these albums that sound wildly different from each other. You have the Bay sound. You have New York rap. You start having the South, and you have L.A., obviously. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I would argue that 93 is rap's greatest year.
All right. I'm not going to argue the point because I'm the host and you're the guest.
That's fair.
But, you know, we're talking about the summer of 93, but we kind of need to bookend or bracket that summer with a couple of major releases, right?
Sure. Well, 93 really starts in 92. On December 22nd, a little album called The Chronic was released, and that dominated everybody's year, right? Mm-hmm. Single after single came out, Nothing But a G Thing hit like crazy, Dre Day hit like crazy, and it introduced all these characters, Snoop not least among them. and really sort of furthered this sound that NWA had been pushing and that was really popular in New York. People don't mm-hmm. remember that, but NWA was huge here.
So Dr. Dre gets things started at mm-hmm. the end of the previous year. And then towards the end of 93, another kind of seismic shift happens.
The Wu enters.
Enter the Wu. The Wu-Tang Clan's 36 Chambers comes out in November of 93. What is different? This is such a leading question. What is different about the Wu-Tang Clan?
The raw, rugged sound. It's you strip away the funk, you pull in the soul. It's more heartbreaking. There are more tears. And you have eight rappers that are less smooth, mm-hmm. is the good way to say it.
And that's before you get into the martial arts and the chess and all the rest of that.
Even before, yeah.
Wu-Tang Clan from an album released late in 1993. Enter the Wu-Tang, 36 Chambers. As it's shorty, shouldn't be so rough. But as the world turned, I learned life was hell. Living in the world, no different from a cell. Every day I skate from takes, giving chase, selling bass, smoking bones in the staircase. Though I don't know why I chose to smoke cess. I guess that's the time when I'm not depressed, but I'm still depressed. And I ask, what's it worth? Ready to give up, so I seek the old earth. Who explained working hard? A little bit of Wu-Tang Clan's Cream from their album Enter the Wu-Tang, 36 Chambers, released towards the end of the year that we're talking about, 1993. Franny Kelly is with me, music editor for NPR Music. You can find a link to NPR Music's coverage of hip-hop in 93 on our website at soundcheck.org. So we've bookended the year with Dr. Dre at the beginning and Wu-Tang Clan at the end. Let's go back to the summer now, middle of 1993. What was the media landscape like 20 years ago today?
As far as hip-hop's concerned, you have college radio making this happen. And then slowly, it moves into commercial radio. 1993 is the year that Power 106 in L.A. and Hot 97 in New York switched from a freestyle dance format to a hip-hop format. Those stations were owned by the same company.
These are big commercial stations pumping out the wattage. They're reaching potentially millions of people just in New York and L.A.
Yeah, that's right. And instead of the argument being like, we shouldn't play one rap record after another, they're like, screw it, let's play it all.
What about MTV? You know, their much publicized kind of fear of rap in the 80s. By 1993, they've sort of gone the other way, haven't they?
Right. Well, Yo MTV Raps exists. And one act that really benefited from both commercial radio and MTV's sort of opening the doors was Onyx. And their song Slam went huge. Mm-hmm. And that was a very deliberate move on their part. It was that they were actually recommended by Jam Master Jay. He told them, okay, make a record that is as aggressive as a song called Throw Your Guns, which was huge in New York, but top 40 lyrically friendly. Well, it's another word. Made it sort of funny, cartoonish, and it went nuts.
Speaking of cartoonish, this is also the summer. We mentioned this song on the show yesterday. This is the summer of Whoomp, There It Is, another massive hit. Now, you mentioned before the South beginning to rise. Tag team was Atlanta, is that
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right. So what's happening in Atlanta is it's mostly very underground. It's sort of Dungeon Family, Outkast, they're bubbling up. But Jermaine Dupri is also like starting to build his empire. He signs Criss Cross. They have a single this summer, for example. And but it's not the Atlanta we know today.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, you know, when you look back and you assume that the players now existed back then. It's not true.
So we're talking about the summer of 93. Biz Markie has a record called All Samples Cleared, the title of which refers to another kind of sea change in the world of hip-hop around this time.
Yeah, that's right. So he had a song called Alone Again that was, there was a lawsuit against it. Gilbert O'Sullivan was like, you can't use my song.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a judge who ruled in a way that was much more harsh than had been done in the past. First of all, he charged Bismarcky and his label hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then he referred the matter to criminal court, and he was basically saying that he stole
right.
this property. So this scared everybody. And also, the Turtles had a lawsuit against De La Soul.
Right.
Yeah. So in response to this, Bismarcky makes an album, the cover of which is him wearing like a British judge wig mm-hmm. and robe.
And he's both the judge and the kind of the defendant in
on the cover. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
So all samples cleared. Did he truly clear all the samples on this record?
I have no idea.
He must have.
I'm not trying to get him in trouble. I'm not going to do it.
Let Me Turn You On is the name of the song, Bismarcky from 1993.
Stop me now. I'm the kind of guy that could really turn you on. Give you so much loving and treat you on. Just hold me close and hold me tight. And let's make love tonight. And I swear to you, baby, I treat you right. If you're the kind of girl that I've been looking for, be real good to me, baby. Let me be your toy. I don't stop the way I'm feeling. Just keep on turning me on. And I swear to you, baby, I love you all night long. Somebody say, well, well.
That is Bismarcky. So, Franny, years before Kanye West was able to get away with singing poorly, Bismarcky. You know, he's just out there. There's no auto-tune in 1993. He's just out there letting it all hang out. Let Me Turn You On is from the Bismarcky record All Samples Cleared, an album released on the heels of big, groundbreaking, precedent-making lawsuits against Bismarcky and the guys in De La Soul on the whole, you know, copyright versus the freedom to sample. We're speaking with Franny Kelly about 1993, really a summer of sea changes in the world of hip-hop, as it was in the world of pop music. Where were the big stars? What was Tupac doing back in 93?
Oh, he put an album out, it also in the fall. And what he did on that album is how we really remember him, which he has these two sides to his personality. He's sort of the socio-political commentator and the party guy, right? So he puts out I Get Around and Keep Your Head Up.
You know what's funny? When it rains, it pours. They got money for wars, but can't feed the poor. Said it ain't no hope for the youth, and the truth is it ain't no hope for the future. And then they wonder why we crazy. I blame my mother for turning my brother into a crack baby. We ain't meant to survive, cause it's a setup. And even though you're fed up, you got to your head.
You mentioned, I mean, Tupac is, you know, that's West Coast. And, mm-hmm. you know, when we think of East Coast, West Coast, we think New York, L.A. But you alluded before to the Bay Area.
I did.
Something was in the water back then in the San Francisco.
E-40, Mac Dre, Mac Mall, Sugar T, The Coup.
Mm-hmm.
Just all these guys making really, really different sounding albums happening in the same year. We spoke to Sway about this. So he was a radio host at KMEL at that time. And he said the reason was that the big record labels in New York and L.A. were sort of ignoring what was happening in the Bay. And so everybody had freedom to not only develop their own styles, but also set up their own business models. So E-40 is selling hundreds of thousands of tapes out of the back of his car. You know, by the time he's selling CDs, he's like, he's got an audience. He's made it happen already.
And Del the Funky Homo Sapien.
That's right. Him too.
And you mentioned The Coup, who are still going, played live here in our studio earlier year. But 20 years ago, The Coup released the album called Kill My Landlord.
The tip of my mouth say tongue deficit.
Money spent.
Catch the glint.
On my nine as they cut welfare 25%.
And I descent as I clinch and raise my
we
fist.
We did away with that.
So you could get with this. It's a twist cause we're overflow like Kwame Nkrumah. Spread around the world as if it were a vicious rumor. Bam, cuts a record like a surgeon cuts a tumor from a brain.
We're all cooped up, so feel the pain.
From 400
years of exploitation, anesthesia provided by your local TV station. Patience is not a virtue.
I ain't waiting.
Turn it over like Bush did a boatload of hate.
That is the coup. They're still going strong in the Bay Area, as they were 20 years ago in the summer of 93. Dig It comes from their album Kill My Landlord, which was, I should probably just explain, that was an old Saturday Night Live routine. Not quite as dark and violent as it might otherwise seem. Franny Kelly, music editor for NPR Music, here with me in the studio looking back at that summer of 20 years ago. It's the rise of alternative rock music. You know, we see the Nirvanas and the Pearl Jams replacing the new wave bands of the 80s. Alternative hip-hop. I mean, we see Digable Planets coming out, you know, making their first record, Guru's Jazzmatazz and things like that.
Well, sure. And then you have everybody coming out of the Native Tongues movement. You have Tribe Called Quest, Midnight Marauders. Queen Latifah puts out Black Rain that same month. Yeah, and a lot of the people making these albums are listening to alternative rock also. I mean, talking about Onyx earlier, Smells Like Teen Spirit is a part of Slam. Like, this is the vibe of that translated.
Mm-hmm. In the case of Digable Planets, Ishmael Butler will be joining us later this week to kind of reminisce about this album from 20 years ago. Some of this music stands the test of time. It doesn't sound like something, an artifact from a previous generation.
And that album in particular, it sounds real fresh still.
This is called Rebirth of Slick from the album Reachin', a new refutation of time and space by Digable Planets.
Like the breeze float straight out of our lids. Them, they got boo bodies, hard rock Brooklyn kids. Us, floor rush when they DJ booming classics. You dig the crew on the fattest hip-hop record. He touched the kinks and sinks into the sounds. She frequents deep, fatter joints called undergrounds. Our funk zooms like you hit the Mary Jane. They flock to booms, man, Boogie had to change. Who freaks the clips with mad amount percussion? Where kinky hair goes to unthought of dimensions? Why's it so fly? Cause hip-hop kept some drama. When Butterfly rocked the light blue suede boomers. What by the cut? We push it off the corner. How was the buzz entire hip-hop era? Was fresh in fact since they started saying Audi? Cause funk's made fat from right beneath my hood. The pooba of the styles like Miles and like 60s funky worms with waves and perms. Just sending junky rhythms right down your block. We beat to rap, what key beat to lock? But I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that, I'm cool.
Digable Planets from their first album, Reachin', back in 93. And we've been remembering the year in hip-hop with Franny Kelly, music editor for NPR Music. You can find a link to NPR Music's coverage of hip-hop, the year of 93, on our website at soundcheck.org. Franny, been fun looking back with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
Understood the plans. Heard of it and put it to his hands.
Up next, we talk with radio host Ann DeLisi of WDET 101.9 in Detroit about some of her picks from the summer of 93, and later, live music from the British post-punk band Wire. This is Soundcheck.
USURYLI. BBFC, HOPP.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now in our week-long Summer of 93 series. We're looking at hit singles and landmark albums from that summer 20 years ago. And we've asked radio host Ann DeLisi from WDET in Detroit to weigh in with a few picks of her own. You can hear her show, Ann DeLisi's Essential Music Weekends, on WDET and WDET.org. She's on the line from their studios in Detroit. Ann, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So, what were you listening to 20 years ago today?
Well, it's funny because I was working here, as a matter of fact. So, it was my first go-around at WDET, so I was working here.
Hmm.
I was listening to stuff that I certainly played on the radio, but an album that I didn't play, which I liked, was Nirvana's In Utero.
Now, that's the Nirvana. This is a really interesting story because, of course, Nevermind was a game changer. This album is hugely anticipated. What did you think of it the first time you heard it through?
To me, and I've, you know, heard so many, you know, there were so many critics coming out and talking about how, you know, it was so dramatically different. And to me, it felt like a natural progression for them. You know, their first album in some people's minds, and in my mind as well, was sort of slickly produced. I mean, in some ways it was a lot of big guitars and Kurt Cobain's voice, but it had some real pop production on it, I thought. And so the production just took it in another direction. And Kurt Cobain himself said he didn't think this was any harder or all that much different than anything that they had done before. But the production was certainly different on this.
Nirvana's 1993 album, In Utero, begins with that song, Serve the Servants, and Ann DeLisi of WDET in Detroit, reminiscing about some of the important albums and singles for her in that summer of 20 years ago. I gotta say, Ann, the first time I heard In Utero, you know, I was a little disappointed, but it's an album that sort of grew on me, but it sounds like you were right there with them from day one.
Well, if you just listen to that song, it's as melodic as anything that they did on Nevermind.
Mm-hmm.
The production is different. Like to me, when I notice Kurt Cobain's voice is almost mixed there like another instrument. It's not quite as out front
right, as
I would say the production was on Nevermind. So it does feel a little grungier. It was meant to. That's exactly what Steve Albini wanted to do. I mean,
this
production process was very fast. It was done in 2 weeks. Steve Albini mixed this album in 5 days. And so a lot of the production was different. At one point, he had Dave Grohl recording with 30 microphones on his drum kit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just an interesting time. But they wanted him to produce this record. You know, two of Kurt Cobain's favorite albums were Surfer Rosa by the Pixies and Music by the Breeders. And so Steve Albini was sort of the person that they wanted. And they wanted to capture a little bit more of that harder sound. But nevertheless, their music was still, for the most part, I thought, as melodic as anything on Nevermind. And what was also interesting is how they didn't want any interruption from their record company. So they put up the money themselves. It only cost $24,000 to make this album.
Wow. Well, that was good return on investment for the guys in Nirvana.
Right?
Speaking with Ann DeLisi from WDET in Detroit, what about, let's move on to Björk.
Okay.
July 1993, the Icelandic singer, she has a bit of a reputation from her band, the Sugar Cubes, releases her album debut, which is in fact her second record. It's not her
right.
debut. Why is this an important album for you from 1993?
Well, it was interesting to watch this artist take a bunch of songs that she had been hanging on to. And she basically said they were not punk songs and they couldn't be done by the Sugar Cubes. And she was really ready to do this. And what I found fascinating about her is that she really stepped into some territory that was maybe foreign to her. You know, she ended up working with jazz artist Oliver Lake.
Yeah.
She did a classical, you know, Corey Hale, the harpist, was on this album too. And that she really sort of found her way through this to make her own sound, which was definitely different than anything that the Sugar Cubes had done. And so she ended up using everything. She did jazz standards. You know, she was recording all kinds of things. And then there was some house and electronic influences on this album. And, you know, people seem to be very divided about Björk. There seems to be like you're in one camp or the other. But for those people that loved her, they were passionate about what she did here. There's definitely no logic to show.
Björk from the album Debut and Human Behavior, one of several singles that came off that record released in the summer of 1993, 20 years ago. Anne DeLisi was already at WDET in Detroit, where she still is, our sister station at 101.9 FM in Detroit. Anne hosts Anne DeLisi's Essential Music, and these are some of the essential tunes and albums from 1993. What about Sheryl Crow? She was kind of ubiquitous that summer, wasn't she?
Well, you know, I was the first person to play her in Detroit. Like, it was months before anybody actually at a commercial station decided to play her music. And so I said, oh, this is kind of interesting. You know, there was a lot of different kinds of, you know, styles on this album.
Mm-hmm.
But I found it interesting that it took a long time. There was a long gestation period for this album. But this collective of songwriters that she worked with were really wonderful writers in their own right, and they basically would get together on Tuesday nights and start writing, and that was sort of the genesis for Tuesday Night Music Club. And it's interesting, if you look at all the aftermath after the success of this album, that's when all of the accusations started going back and forth as to who wrote what and all those kinds of things. It was interesting to watch.
So how did you get onto this album months before commercial radio did?
I did. It came to the station. I listened to it, and I thought, you know what? I think there's something here. And so I just started to play it. I was talking to Craig Folly, who does a Craig Folly show here, and he said, oh, I remember. We were the only ones playing this thing. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking to myself, what's it going to take? This is so obvious. You know, to me, there were songs on there that were so obvious that would be perfect for commercial radio. And then, of course, months later, they started to pick up on it. Yeah, they were. They did. It happened.
All I Want to Do was inescapable that summer, but there were lots of other. I mean, it was a pretty deep record. This song from Sheryl Crow was called Strong Enough.
Nothing's true and nothing's right.
Strong Enough from Sheryl Crow's all-universe-encompassing record, Tuesday Night Music Club. It was one of the big records of the summer of 1993, the huge hit All I Want to Do. But that song, Strong Enough, got a fair amount of attention, too, including from Anne DeLisi, who's with me on the line. Anne, you mentioned Craig Folly there at WDET. He's going to be joining us tomorrow to talk about life and music in Detroit that summer 20 years ago. Before I let you go, though, we asked you not just for a couple of albums, but to pick one of the big number one singles of the summer. You only had a handful to choose from. Why did you choose UB40?
I basically remember it being surprising to me that they took an Elvis Presley hit and changed it so dramatically, and that everybody sort of heard it as a brand new song.
Mm.
And then it was everywhere. It was for weeks. I guess it was number one for 7 weeks or something.
7 weeks from July 24th to September 4th, 1993, we checked.
Right, exactly. And so you guys are all over it there. And so it was just kind of surprising to me. I thought this was an Elvis Presley song, and tons of people would never know that, you know. And
so was it good surprise, weird surprise, ew
weird.
Surprise, weird?
A little between ew and weird. Thought, you know what, why is this happening? But it just goes to show you that, you know, people can take a song and make it their own and just change it around. And that's exactly what they did, because it was totally different than Elvis Presley's version was. But they made it work for them, that's for sure.
It was one of the big hits of the summer of 93, UB40's version of I Can't Help Falling in Love with You. And Elise, nice talking with you again.
Thank you so much.
Sounds from the summer of 20 years ago. Soundcheck listeners, give us a call. Tell us where you were, what you were listening to during the summer of 93. We're at 866-939-1612. And David is on the line with us from right here in New York. David, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John. Great shows.
Thanks. Now, I understand that you were the music critic for the Sacramento Bee back in 93. Is that right?
That's right, I was.
So what was in the air? What was in print? What were you covering back then?
Oh, well, you know, a lot of different things. A lot of the things that you've already mentioned. Zooropa, of course, was big. In
the
Utero
record,
was big.
Yeah.
But the one that in Northern California, I don't know what it was like around these parts because I was in Northern California, but the big record of that year was Counting Crows, August and Everything After. And it was funny because I've been listening to the show, and A lot of the music that people remember had sort of a harder edge, where it's Nirvana or Smashing Pumpkins, or, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was sort of in the grunge or post-grunge era. And Counting Crows were a little bit more sort of a bridge between the boomers and the Gen X sort of grunge movement, I think. And they kind of split the difference and had a lot of references to Van Morrison and even things like name-checking Dylan's Mr. Jones on the big hit from the album.
The song called Mr. Jones. David, thanks very much for the call. From 1993 in the album August and Everything After, this is Counting Crows.
Yeah, well, you know, gray is my favorite color. I felt so symbolic yesterday. If I knew Picasso, I would buy myself a ring and saw him play Mr. Jones. Let me look into the future.
That is the band Counting Crows, featuring the very literate Adam Duritz on vocals, Mr. Jones, from their 1993 record August and Everything After. We're remembering the summer of 93 with some of our listeners. Brad is on the line from Michigan. Brad, where were you in the summer of 93, and what were you listening to?
The summer of 1993, I was just turning 13 in the suburbs of Detroit. And what I was listening to, I had just received my first CD player for my 13th birthday. Pretty much staples that you guys had previously mentioned, Counting Crows, In Utero. Also the Beastie Boys, Check Your Head, and a lot of Guns N' Roses. A lot of Guns N' Roses.
So summer of 93, you're still listening. I mean, this we talked about this on the show yesterday, that a lot of music that was a year or two old was still very popular that summer. The Guns N' Roses would have been like a year and a half old by that point, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
So from the album Use Your Illusion, pick a track for us.
I'd say You Could Be Mine.
That's a good one. All right, let's
you
hear
could be mine.
Brad, thanks for the call. Let's hear Guns N' Roses from 1993. You Could Be Mine from the 1991 album Use Your Illusion by Guns N' Roses, but Brad from Michigan was still listening to that during the summer of 93. Coming up next on Soundcheck, the British post-punk band Wire recently released their 13th studio record. It's called Change Becomes Us, and they're going to play a live set here in the studio next on Soundcheck.
Soundcheck.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In 1977, a British band named Wire released their first album, the still-celebrated Pink Flag. Now, over 35 years later, Wire is back with their 13th studio album. But it's one that looks back to their early days, because the new record, Change Becomes Us, features some updates on musical sketches that the band wrote more than three decades ago for an album that never happened. In the background, you're hearing one of those sketches recorded in 1980, and now you're going to hear the new song based on that old sketch. Here is Wire with Love Bends live on Soundcheck.
They make you feel good.
That is Wire, live on Soundcheck with the song Love Bends, which you will find on their new album called Change Becomes Us. Let me introduce you to the members of the band. Joining me at the microphones, Colin Newman, singing
Hello.
And playing guitar. Graham Lewis.
Hello.
Playing bass and singing as well. Also with us, Matthew Sims on guitar, Robert Gray on drums. So this, Colin, is very close to the classic Wire lineup. You could actually put the E back on. It's not were well, any E's, Wire.
The E is back on, yeah. I mean, Wire is a two-guitar, bass and drums band. It doesn't mean to say that, you know, we might not take other formats mm-hmm. with those people, but... Wire is very much back to being a four-piece again. Yeah.
Right. For a while, you were sort of half-jokingly referring when Bruce Gilbert left the band to Wire as were. Just
No, that's already going back another. Too much history.
Am I back in 1993 again?
You are back. You're living in 93.
No. It's all wrong. It's completely wrong. No, actually, it was when Robert left.
Ah, right.
When Robert quit.
Yeah. Everyone's
when we dropped the E. I'm the only original member, actually. Everyone else has left.
At least once.
So you, Graham, are a lifer, then,
when
it comes to Wire.
I'm hoping to get parole soon.
Now, this record, Change Becomes Us, I mentioned in the introduction, there were these... I don't want to say songs, really. They were sketches of songs, right?
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
It's Change Becomes Us.
Mm-hmm. What did I say?
You say it like there are two meanings of it. The first meaning is actually about change becoming us, becoming like as it...
So Change Becomes Us as yeah. opposed to Change Becomes...
No. The second one is, if you say becomes us, it means like it suits us.
Right.
But that's a secondary meaning. The first meaning is actually change becomes us. Change is becoming us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a description of the band and the process, and perhaps of the album as well.
Okay, well...
Which does fit rather well into your original question, because it's the thing about this material, which we left... on the field of battle in 1980 when we all span off in different directions. Some of that material had been played maybe a couple of times, mm-hmm. and a lot of the things were only performed once, particularly the things from the Electric Ballroom, which was... It was constructed as more of a, should we say, a performance confrontation rather than a symphonic event. So... You know what I mean? The things there were there to sort of serve the punk, to serve that function. Right. So the work hadn't really been explored or edited using the process which we usually use, which is pretty exacting because, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of work gets binned along the way.
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, David Byrne did his first record for Nonesuch, and he came on the show and talked about a, kind of a different writing process. And I asked him, when you listen to those old Talking Head songs now, could you write like that now? And he paused for a moment, and then he said, no, I couldn't.
That's a very interesting question, actually, because one of the reasons why I wanted to engage in this process is because there's been an evolution over the past two or three years. During the 90s and really the last decade, making music very often consisted of a variation of the hip-hop method, which is, you know, you put things together. They can be live performances. It can be a full band live performance. But it's a way of you put the music together, and if it's vocal music, then you sing on top of the thing which has been put together. And I felt that when we got to the point of when we made the last album, Red Bark Tree, I thought it would be really interesting to dispense with that completely and go back to saying, OK, I'm going to write some songs on acoustic guitar, and the band is going to learn them, and that we're going to make the album out of that. I mean, it didn't receive a great reception at the beginning, but I mean, everybody got into it because it's mm-hmm. a matter of what, as soon as people get the thing is it's very it becomes much easier to own the material in that way because there are no pre-written parts. You've got to figure out what your part is, so nobody's doing your part for you or saying, yeah, well, that, well, you've got to have that bit because I've got that loop or something like that. It is what you make between you. And then I thought, well, that's interesting. Those songs sound like someone who hasn't played written songs on acoustic guitar for 20 years, which is, you know, pretty much what it is. It's someone quite excited about playing. It's like one little riff with two notes in it, and, you know, it's. And then when I started thinking about this material that's ended up on Change Becomes Us, I thought, hang on, what that material sounds like, it's been written by somebody who's written quite a lot of songs and is already bored with everything that you can write in an acoustic guitar. And I thought, yeah, but I need some of that in my writing now. Mm. So it was a kind of, for me, it was a challenge to say, let's engage with that, because that's going to force me into a direction where I engage with a certain kind of guerrilla sophistication in the writing.
The thing about it is it also came about out of sheer necessity, really, because we toured quite a lot in 2011. Excuse me. I've got a sore throat.
Rock and roll.
Yeah. Now, you see, and in 2011, we worked a lot with Matt, came into the group to play second guitar. And by the end of that work, a new aesthetic had actually come about within the group, and we had a lot of confidence with what we were doing. And it seemed, you know, that it would have been very, very foolish not to have made an encounter with some material to do that. And as Colin said, you know, this stuff has been lying around for ages, and we have dipped into it. Mm-hmm. We've used things for, like, underwater experiences and things over the years. So it's not completely alien territory. But
can you explain underwater experiences?
Underwater experiences.
It's existed in at least I think two or three versions. There was a version that was attempted on Chairs Missing. The problem was it was a bit like The Blind Leading the Blind. Nobody
Chairs
realized.
Chairs Missing from 1979, okay.
Because nobody, including the person who wrote the tune, me, realized it was in 3/4, and the band were trying to play it in 4/4, and it was just who knows how did we manage that. So it was never recorded, and then the idea came back round again, I think, towards the end of the 70s. And then I developed a more frantic version of it, which basically doesn't have a lot to do with music. It's a kind of like, it's a kind of quite a heavy riff, as a sort of a guitar alarm guitar, followed by a heavy riff.
Well, Graham used
shouting.
The word confrontation before, I think. Is that what you were...
It was it's humour, actually.
Okay, all right.
And so that was... So
however,
that was
a, however yeah. I would say the majority of the audience didn't think it was that funny, actually.
Yeah.
No, because
if you don't get the joke, then it is confrontation, yeah. Isn't it?
Well, I thought, you know, at that time, it was a time of reassessment of what had actually been was going on, you know, because we'd gone to what was called punk gigs, you know. Mm-hmm. You went to see the Sex Pistols, and the fun of the whole thing was the people who did not understand that it was a joke, a very serious joke nonetheless, but bloody funny. Mm-hmm. If you were in, and if you weren't, you weren't.
Well, and even, you know, even for someone like me who has followed this band for many, many years, here I am reading your title incorrectly. Change Becomes Us, the name of the record. It's Change Becomes Us.
Yes.
Because otherwise it sounds like something on The Fast Show, which is like an English comedy show, you know. Suits you, sir.
Yeah. That's Graham Lewis. We're also speaking with Colin Newman. Robert Gray and Matthew Sims are also here. So you have reinvented these songs, and the next one you're going to do for us is called Reinvent Your Second Wheel.
Mm.
Graham, you sing this one, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. You guys ready to play it for us?
Sure. Yeah, that was a radio link.
That's, you know, we try not to point those out so much, Colin. Thank you very much. Just let me do my thing while you guys get back to your instruments. The band is Wire, and the album is called Change Becomes Us. And this song called Reinvent Your Second Wheel, another live performance here in the Soundcheck studio.
Thank you. ease up your masking place. Oh, expressionless, your poker face. The BFC is your QB. M-N-Y-J-U-S-D. U-S-U-R-Y-L-I. B-B-F-C H-O-Q-B.
That is Wire, live on Soundcheck with Reinvent Your Second Wheel. It's on their latest album, Change Becomes Us. The band Wire performing live in the Soundcheck studio today. And let's hear another song. This one is called Adore Your Island.
Fragile heads in intensive care. Don't be so worried. You're the one who should be spared. You're the one who should be spared. You're the one who should be spared. Thank you. be so worried. You're the one who should be spared the embarrassment. The pain you need, it's always the same. First I say I love you, and then you're silent. How I adore your island. How I adore your island. You're the one who should be spared.
That is Wire, live on Soundcheck with Adore Your Island, one of the songs from their latest album called Change Becomes Us. Colin Newman sang that one. Graham Lewis sang Reinvent Your Second Wheel, which we heard before. Colin Newman playing guitar, Graham Lewis on bass, Matthew Sims playing guitar and abusing his instrument dreadfully at the end of that song, Robert Gray playing the drums. Live here in the Soundcheck studio. Guys, this has been great fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, John.
That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow, our week-long Summer of 93 series continues with music writer Maura Johnston with her personal picks, including a number one single from a New York City R&B group that recently got its own reality TV show. And radio host Craig Foley talks about what was happening in Detroit musically that summer 20 years ago. And we have live music from the California band that spells its name with exclamation points and which is usually pronounced chick, chick, chick. I'm John Schaefer. See you tomorrow.